Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I hope to open the conversation about working parents a bit. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier, to find out how they balance being a dad with a successful career. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for being patient with us and for listening to our show as always. And we hope you've been enjoying the bonus clips. If you miss Robin Rich, yes, I speak about myself in the third person. If you miss us, we've continued to publish new episodes of our Kings of Con podcast. So check that out. You can find it anywhere you listen to your podcasts. It's called Kings of Con, the podcast. If you really like us, you can be a member of the Patreon team, the infamous Baldwins, who benefit by getting bonus content from Robin Rich, including video, every week. So if you haven't started listening, we thought we might get you started with an episode that featured our friend from the show that we were all on together, Mark Shepard. So please enjoy this episode, and we'll be back with new episodes of Supernatural Then and Now very soon.
Hey, hey, what's going on? Rob and Rich are the kings of con.
Live from Fartoon Studios and wherever Rich is, it's Kings of Con, the podcast.
This week's guest,
the kings of con,
Mark Shepard.
You know, Rob and I did a little podcast the other day, a couple weeks ago now, but we did the 3-2-1 clap, and on my end, it was literally the first time ever it was exactly synced. It was like, boom. And Rob was like, oh, what a train wreck. You're jerking me around. I'm like, there's definitely an internet difference here. Like, it's not us. Yeah. It's it, yeah. You know? So.
But it also, it's Rich.
But not us, yeah.
But it's also me.
Hey, Rich, so, how funny was it when Hank responded to you last? Like,
oh,
one,
so
two,
funny.
Three, four, fuck you, Evan.
It was so funny. Definitely not you. Hank, definitely not your voice. You know what I mean?
I went out with Hank last night, and I showed him a picture or something. He had my phone. And while he's looking at my phone, Richard Pipes just texts me randomly, what's your address? So I just saw him punching something in, and I don't know what he was doing. I was like, what'd you just do? And he responded, 123 fuck you, Avenue.
It's actually 1234 fuck you. It was the 1200 block of fuck you, Avenue.
Perfect Hank response.
It was very funny. And so part of the fun of doing this last podcast, Tina, was Rob and I realized after 2 years of doing this, I mean, it was the first time we've been in the same room.
Yeah.
I know.
Totally changed the dynamic. I was like, whoa. I mean.
Yeah, we texted you that picture, right?
Yeah. And I was like, oh, you're together.
Yeah. It definitely made Rob and I think, man, you know, I should be rolling over to his Fartoon Studios to be doing this because.
Yeah.
I know. And so we went out after, we had a drink. We said, hey, Thursday or Friday, you're coming over to my house.
We did say that, didn't we?
And so here we are.
Oh, well.
Back on
here
Zoom.
Here we are.
I mean, it's after school. All the kids are out. It's tough. But we should, if we can do it, it was pretty great.
No.
So,
okay, let's get this party started. Okay, Mark Andreas Shepard.
Andreas?
Uh-huh.
Like an Andreas. So if it's his fault, we can say, well, it's Andreas' fault.
Andreas' fault. Is an English actor and musician, drummer. He's often credited as Mark A. Shepard.
Mark A. Shepard.
Mark A. Shepard. And that's why I thought it was appropriate to get him on for Christmas.
Right.
Shepard is known for playing the demon King of Hell Crowley on Supernatural and for his recurring roles as Romo Lampkin on Battlestar Galactica, Interpol investigator James Sterling on Leverage, and small-time crime lord Badger on Joss Whedon's Firefly, amongst many, many other things.
Oh, yeah.
Finally, the day has come. We can welcome the one and only
Mark
Shepard.
Shepard.
To
He's so close. I can feel it. I'm on pins and needles.
Oh.
Mark.
I admitted him.
It's like he's
almost.
Wait.
Yay!
Yes.
Hey. I want to be at that backyard. What's up, Mark?
How's it going?
It's going very well. Dude, long time no see.
What's going down? Is that ahead of you or me on your shelf?
It's are you sure, Rob? It could be.
It could be me.
I went to the head shop and I said,
what do you have in a shepherd? He said.
Okay, so where in the world are you, Carmen Miranda?
Well, Rob's in his home studio.
Yeah.
I'm in the home office, so I'm in Los Angeles, California as well. And Tina's in a trailer, but also Los Angeles, California.
I'm on set right now. I snuck away.
And you, I assume, are in your glorious backyard.
I'm in the backyard. Yeah. Nice.
Lovely. That's nice. So cool.
Yeah, dude.
Nice fountain.
Wow.
It's awesome.
And
smoking a cigar,
as
you like to do.
Smoking a stogie, healing.
Yeah, is that all good. New?
Yeah.
He's showing us his tattooed arm.
Wait a minute. So that's...
It's fantastic.
All new.
Very
That's
new.
Substantial, dude. Man. That's awesome.
Well, you remember, I used to have them at the top of my arm.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. How much does that hurt? Gonna,
right now? Yeah. Quite a lot, actually.
Does it?
That was Monday, so I'll be back in tomorrow.
How many days have you been doing... How long has this process been on the new tattoos?
Like 5... sessions of 7 to 10 hours each.
Good.
Wow.
Gravy.
Wow.
That's no joke. Are you doing it in the what area? Where are you doing this?
In LA. It's a very weird story. An old friend of mine, Kevin Quinn, who was quite a famous tattooist. He we had a mutual friend and I knew him 30 odd years ago. And he tattooed at Sunset Strip, he tattooed at Hanky Panky in Amsterdam, and he was just a really famous guy. Like the famous story about him tattooing Guns N' Roses, he went on tour with them for like 3 or 4 months and traveled the world with them. And then Duff one day, I think when Duff got sober, he turned around, he goes, "Man, you were on tour with us. I'm just so sorry I never got tattooed by you." And Kevin was like, "I did that one. I did that one." He did that one. It was, So he and I are survivors of an era. I think he's a great musician. I'm actually wearing a shirt in his honor.
Oh, cool.
From Detroit.
Oh, nice.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
Family shirt.
Yeah, it's just one for the kids. Nothing says Merry Christmas, kids, like a syringe there on the T-shirt.
Okay, well, it's kind of the embodiment.
The T's
of Detroit.
In Detroit are both syringes for those following along on the podcast.
Right.
There you go.
Exactly. Is that the name of the band, Baker Drivetrain?
No. That's actually Baker Drivetrain is Transmissions for Harley Davidson Motorcycles. Mm. That's the best way to explain it to you.
Well, that's cool. So, if you have to ask, you're not a Harley.
Well, look, you got to remember, I didn't start out as an actor. I started out as a musician. Right. So there's a whole part of my history which is connected to me surviving that era of my life. And as you both know very, very well, I stopped playing for 20 years after I got sober. I didn't pick up a pair of drumsticks. I didn't do anything. And bizarrely enough, thanks to Loudon Swain and you especially I think Billy kind of bullied me into playing one day.
Your panel. So you're on stage at your panel and sort of answer questions, not as a musician, but sort of as an actor. And Billy was like, "Well, let's see it then. Get on the drum kit." You're like, "All right, I'll get on the drum kit." And we played Back in Black. And
the nicest thing that Billy said afterwards is, "Oh, you play drums."
Yeah, now you play drums.
And in typical Mark Shepard form, it was it's a great band story. You played it, and then you told us that we were playing it wrong.
You played it too fast.
Playing it wrong.
but that's Mark Shepherd for thank you guys. You're playing
exactly,
it wrong.
Exactly. That's Mark Shepherd for that was really fun, guys.
Yeah.
Which is why I keep Robin Rich around is to translate all
the Shepherd.
The
we speak Shepherd.
I have in life.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
So Mark, I have a question for you. You're talking about your music years. What, and you're talking about that era. What time frame? Like from when to when? When is your sort of your music window?
So I started playing drums around 12 years old. And my dad lived in a house with the mother of... the drummer from Madness, Woody, who became the drummer of Madness at that
and
point.
And what city? Give me a city. Where are you at this point?
That was in London. Okay. And was in London, England. And she was the floor manager of Top of the Pops, which was the chart show in England.
Yeah, big deal.
So they had thousands of records. So I was listening to, you know, obscure, interesting vinyl at around, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. And I bought my first drum kit off Woody when I think I was 12 or 13. And I ended up working in a drum shop on Portobello Road in London. And then I ended up making records from about the age of 15 onwards. I was signed to Rough Trade and I probably made 30 or so albums.
And as a studio drummer or with a certain band?
As a studio drummer with certain bands. I was with the TV Personalities and I was with ancillary bands to that. It's the weird bands that in the very, very early 80s were the musician bands. You know what I'm saying? They're the bands that sort of influenced other bands. So I first played with Robin Hitchcock when I was 17 in, I'd say, 1980. And I finished playing with him in 1981. I was just a kid then. I toured with him. And bizarrely enough, when I finished Supernatural, I went out and toured with him again in 2017.
Oh, that's great.
So I went out and played, you know, 40 years of his music and had a lot of fun doing so.
Now, when you were playing with Robin Hitchcock and you were 17, what's the age gap there? Like, was he 19 or, you know, what's it?
Robin's 60, 65, 66, I think. So he's...
So he's early 20s at that point?
Yeah, he's 8 years older, 9 years older yeah, than okay. me. Yeah. And you know, he was in the Soft Boys, and the Soft Boys were like my favorite band. I went up to him once at a gig and said, can I play in your band? And so he was like, okay. So we did it.
Wow. Well, that's how all negotiations go, kids. So if you're dreaming of
being a drummer, all negotiations should go, especially in our
just
business.
Walk up to your favorite musician and say, can I be in your band? And that's how you get in the band.
So no acting at that point for you?
Well, when I was 17 years old, a casting director, there was a lot of weird things going on in London. Like, you know, Spinal Tap was being cast out of London and sort of stuff. And I was a drummer. So they were asking if I, you know, may be interested or whatever. And I wasn't particularly interested in doing that. I don't know why.
Well,
I
think any drummer from Spinal Tap, that's only like a day of work. Because then you explode.
The spontaneous combustion element was not my favorite part. But then there was this film that came up, and with this film, it would have changed the trajectory of what I was doing at the time. And I came second to a very, very good actor. And I got offered another film, and I just turned it down. And I said, no, I don't want to do this, because I didn't like the rejection. So now I do it for a living.
Yeah, funny how that works.
Wait,
so
can we know what
was
it was?
The film?
What you missed out on and who the actor was?
Yeah, I know what it was. Two big films.
You can't tell us?
Well, yeah, Tim Roth got both the roles, which I thought was quite funny. So the first one was Made in Britain, which was amazing.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern? No.
No, the second one was the Hit, with Terrence Stamp.
Oh, nice.
So, it was one of those weird things. I decided to go make a record instead. So at the time that film was being made, I was at Rockfield in Wales. Well, they did Bohemian Rhapsody, doing a Barracuda's record.
Wow.
And so I toured the world. I mean, I watched Spinal Tap. The first time I watched Spinal Tap, I didn't laugh. Because everything that ever happened in Spinal Tap had happened to me at that
time. Close to home?
It was literally, I mean, I've had band members arrested and taken to hospital for gigs. Pay attention.
I got
Richard.
Frank in here. News in the world.
Hey, Frank? I haven't seen Frank in ages.
Dude, I haven't seen any of your children in ages. And I'm sure I was thinking about your kids, because I know, oh, there's Frank waving. Say hi. There's Frank.
Hey, Frank. My God, you're getting tall.
That's what I'm saying. Like, he's growing up.
Good looking boy.
Yeah. Takes after his mother, as we like to say.
I was going to say something else, but this is a family show.
Or
he takes after his father, whoever that might be.
Or potentially. There's that.
Thank you, Rob. You just spared me the ignominy of that.
It really is sort of the softball, like, And you guys are like, who's picking up the bat? All right.
Yeah. Yes. He's first.
All the kids have grown. I mean, I'm sure your kids, Williams, have got to be, you know.
Max is six foot tall, 22 years old, playing jazz piano. Williams, 16, just doing, getting ready to determine what he wants to do. And he starts, I had to go buy two cars last week.
What?
Jeez.
I had to buy two cars last week. I've got kids who drive cars. It's mind blowing.
Yeah, man.
Luckily, I've got some connections and stuff, because, God, the prices are terrifying. But they're safe, and that's done, and we're all good.
Great.
And I'm working, I'm busy and doing stuff, and finally got a couple of weeks off, so it's good.
It's great. Now, I'm circling back to the music journey, just because I find it fascinating. Because as many conversations as you and I have had, Mark, music has not been the topic of most of them. Like, so I'm interested in knowing, so you're offered these movies, and you're like, man, this ain't for me. I'm a band guy. I like the live. I like the recording.
I chickened out. It was that classic anxiety meets rejection concept at about sort of 17, 18 years old.
Right.
The great story, the bookend to that is I went back after I got sober. I went back to England and I'd done a play in LA because I was the last person in LA they could find to do it. It was ridiculous. And it was a big deal at the time. It was back when 100-seat theater actually meant something.
Right.
I mean, I think Fishburne was doing Two Trains Running. Ed Harris was doing Scar at the Met. Mm-hmm. There was, there was an incredible, I think Kentucky Cycle had just started.
Oh, God,
I mean, it was
that
one
movie.
Of those.
Wow.
Like, it was an amazing time in theater. Yeah. In LA. And so I did Cock and Bull Story with Trevor Goddard. And it was directed by Billy Hayes, the author and protagonist of Midnight Express.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Well, I managed to piss off on the first day by saying, I guess you don't go to Turkey on your holidays then.
Yes. Probably too soon. It was invented from that moment.
Well, I mean, it had been 1978 or whatever.
Wow.
I figured it might be over.
I still think it's too soon.
Yeah.
He wasn't over.
Yeah, clearly.
He was actually more pissed off that the movie didn't end the way he wanted it to end. He actually escaped in a rowboat. So he turned around to Alan Parker at the end of the film and said, "So where's the rowboat?" And Alan Parker said, "Which 45 minutes of the film would you like me to cut out and put the rowboat
in?"
So that was kind of fun. But so I did this play, and it seemed very natural for me to do. And then I went back to the people who tried to cast me in these films in England, and I went and did some amends and some fun stuff. And all those sort of things you do when you get sober. And they were like, "Well, about time." And one of them said, "Well, I'm doing this film, and you're completely wrong for it, but you never know." And it sort of ended this incredible story of insanity. And I was like the third person cast in In the Name of the Father, which was my first film.
Amazing.
Amazing.
And I had no idea what to do as an actor. I mean, I was doing this play and a wonderful old, you remember Barbara Clayman? You guys must remember Barbara Clayman. Barbara Clayman. She did, she worked for Stu Siegel a lot back in the day.
Okay.
And she came to the play and she was like, "Do you have a SAG card?" And I'm like, "No, do I need one?" So she Taft Hartley me in silk stockings.
Wow.
I was like, okay.
You're lucky that's all that happened to you in silk stockings. You know what I'm saying? That kind of show.
No, she didn't put me in silk stockings. She put me in silk stockings. But
there's a lot of people at home who do not know what silk stockings is.
Everybody in the world knows what
I'm
silk
stockings
is.
I'm telling you, there's a generation of people who don't, and they're now Googling you wearing silk stockings. They're going to like, "What? When did he wear?"
Stockings. Stockings.
Yeah, that's not what they're going to Google.
Rob Estes and Mitzi Kapchner.
Dude, Rob Estes. There's a name. I haven't heard that
remember,
name.
Remember Charlie Brill? I love Charlie Brill, the comedian, wonderful guy. But, you know, it just ended up with that. And, you know, a bunch of agents came to the show because it was a big hit. And they're like, "Hey, do you have an agent?" And I'm like, "Do I need one?"
Right.
So I signed to an agent. And then it just became this thing. And I ended up doing X-Files. And so I started killing
but
people.
But at this point, had you said earlier that you got sober and you gave up the drums once you got sober. So was this during your sober period? Were you sober during this period?
Yeah. I connected shooting heroin and drinking with
drums.
With playing music. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know how to not do it that way.
Right. That's what was so cool when you finally did it again, first starting with us and then, of course, getting back together with Robin, was that you discovered that you still were good at it, you still had a love for it, sober.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, without you and the boys and Rich, it was an amazing journey. I watched you guys. This is a band I really like. So I watched Loudon Swain. I'm going, why are they wearing these hats? And why are they playing this crap?
Yeah,
I mean, they really play.
Let's give a backstory there. That was back when Loudon Swain started doing Supernatural conventions, and people who are loyal listeners know the story. But to recap, the only way we could get the boys on the roster was to make up a fake band name and make them a cover band. So, which I did. Swearing in a stack of Bibles that it would work and we'd be able to get him out of the out of the wigs.
I think it's important to note that Rich was the mastermind of the entire thing.
Yeah, and it worked, but there was definitely a lot of trust of like, you want me to do what and play what now? Wearing
we
what?
We weren't a cover band. We didn't do covers. And the idea was we were going to do cover songs. Well, then let's not be ourselves because that's not Loudon Swain.
Yeah, they became the Elastic Waistband.
Yeah,
and they all had personas
and wigs and everything. Yeah.
I need a photograph to be put up at this point of Mike Borja in the hat and the wig that he would wear on a continuous basis.
I don't
basis.
Know Mike Borja. You must be referring to Sir Richard Furlong, his alter ego, which was what we called him during that period.
He was English. He had a really bad English accent.
Robbie, for the Patreon video, maybe you'll slap this the photo
for sure.
up. For yeah,
for sure.
Oh, it's kind of scary. But to love music as I love music, as we all love music, and to have this connection to music, and to watch this, you know, I mean, it's nothing to do with creation. I mean, it's that nobody had ever thought of the idea of putting a proper band or doing a proper gig or doing a proper thing together. And it was this very interesting time where we convinced, I think the three of us convinced the bosses at Creation, Gary and Adam, to give it a go because, you know, everything was done through a vocal PA and everything was done on the lower scale because nobody was thinking about a concert.
Right.
And it very, very quickly turned into something rather wonderful and became a I'd say a runaway success.
I think so.
It was great. It was really, you two really, for lack of a better word, shepherded it. And really kind of made it happen. And allowed us to be ourselves. And, you know, now they got a really good sound system. They don't have a good, still don't have lights.
No.
But you know what Mark did? No. I'll tell you, because it was a team effort. And I remember, because I had sort of greased the wheels to get the band there to start with, and then gotten the idea going of doing something like that. And Mark picked up the ball. And what you were able to do, Mark, which was like completely Swahili to everybody else, is you convinced them to think of it as a band, not actors playing music. And that's what changed the whole like thing.
Because we are.
And subsequently, what was beautiful about it, what was extraordinary about it, was to see all the talent that these actors, who some of whom had never sang publicly and never done anything publicly, being eased into a really good band, being eased into it and being shown that it was possible. And then, I mean, just watching them working their butts off, trying to give the best performance they could possibly give, and having the support of a great show behind them.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, and it went from this tiny little thing to a 53-foot truck. You know, I mean, it's mind blowing, and I loved every minute of it. It was the saving grace of the amount of traveling that we had to do, and the amount of work that we were doing at the time. Yeah. So but it rekindled my love of what it was that we were doing. And I'm eternally grateful to you guys for that.
It was fun.
I think the payback was the hamster at Comic-Con, but that was.
there are great moments in entertainment, and that is one of them. It might be for a limited, it's for a limited 6,000 people, audience who saw it live. It's one of those things you had to be there, but you know, for those who were there.
What I loved was the fact that you were both terrified that I wasn't going to go with the game.
100%.
Oh, yeah.
100% terrified.
We had scenarios in our head. This is the first time we'd ever hosted Comic-Con. They had begged us to show them a script of what we were going to do, and we'd refused because we didn't want, we didn't want our jokes vetted, because then that never goes well. And we're like, well, we're going to do this thing, and we're going to do it. And we're like, we'd run through scenarios like, oh, Mark is going to either be stone faced, storm off stage, maybe lean into it, but I doubt it. But anyway, we had a storm off stage
scenario planned out.
You had one built. Yeah. What were you going to do if I stormed off stage?
We're going to burst into tears. And I think
he was going to go, Robbie, tears.
And Rob and I swore, we swore on a stack of Bibles. We're like, we're not going to tell anybody about this until we're just going to do it on stage. Cut to Rob backstage 15 minutes before we go on, like pulling Misha aside and going, so we're going to do this bit. And Misha's like, oof.
Bad idea.
Like, and so I'm not like, so Rob did the thing he swore he wouldn't do and got the response we knew he'd get, which was, unless you see this thing, it doesn't sound like it's going to work.
And then I said to Rich, I was like, we shouldn't do it. Sweating. But
it was so perfect. So the bottom line was, is that, you've got to start from the basis that it's all about love. The fact that we have an audience that we have, and that we've been able to be ourselves in so many situations and actually genuinely go through the things we've gone through in life, survive the things we've survived in life, birth, marriages, deaths, near death experiences, everything that's happened, we've done rather publicly. Yeah. I think it's kind of extraordinary if you think about it. Everybody says, I'm in a show, it's a family. And you're like, oh God, you start cringing because the reason we came up with Supernatural Family was because we were sick of the idea of fanatic. We always hated the word fanatic and fan, and that idea that it was something
like an us and them thing. We didn't like.
Yeah, and also worthy of derision and worthy of mimicry. And you know, we knew our audience really, really well. And the upshot of that is, you can take this in any direction. It's like, every single day of our lives, we bump into somebody who's a fan of the show and says something to us about what the show means to us. And that is extraordinary. But, looking out at a Loudon Swain audience at a gig, and they're singing every word, every single word. The first time I saw the Kazoos, I nearly wet myself laughing. I thought it was the greatest thing. And this carries on. This carried on with our blooper reels. This carried on with our conduct on set. Right. This carried on with our conduct with each other.
Explain the Kazoos, Rob, so that people.
We have a song called "Medicated," and in the middle, there's a kazoo solo, and so fans would start
forced you to do as the encore. Do you remember?
Right, yeah, yeah. And we'd have,
they forced you. I was like, this is the greatest encore.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, we'd bring the actors on stage.
Fat Bottom Girls.
We'd bring actors on stage with kazoos. And anyway, there's a kazoo.
But the audience had kazoos. The point was the audience would bring out, you'd end up with 1,500 kazoos in the audience.
Yeah, yeah. It was amazing.
By the way, not a COVID-friendly instrument, the kazoo.
No, we used to do this thing where we would go into the merch room in the middle of the day Saturday before we signed autographs and do medicated, and everybody would. And if you didn't have a kazoo, you just put your finger in your mouth and go, beep, 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 beep. And it was this really fun thing. We cannot do that anymore.
No,
that
may
is not,
not
happening.
No, yeah,
it's not COVID. Not a
CDC
COVID
says no more medicated from Loudon and Swain.
Medicated.
I'm not sure that's exactly what they say.
You know, Mark, you always said something in your panel. Because you know, we'd intro you, and then we'd come on the convention stage to outro you, and you were always wrapping up with something, regardless of how the hijinks that you had pulled off in the middle of your panel, how silly or serious or whatever it had been, you always ended with one of these lines. You would throw this in there, and I always thought it was so well stated. I would love to know if it's your own or if it's something you picked up along the way, but you would always say, "I don't trust somebody who's not a fan of something." Like,
that's mine.
And I always thought that was so meaningful, especially to everybody in the audience, because it's like, for anybody who feels like it's us and them, for anybody who feels like I'm a fan of that person on the stage, ergo we are different, I've always thought you eloquently and simply made that not the case. You know what I mean?
It was kind of weirdly my job. Warner Brothers used me a lot to do that with DVDs and stuff. And you know, it would be my job to sort of codify certain aspects of it, of the show. For public audiences, it was like, you know, we were given talking points or we were given things to do for the 8 years that I was there. And the bottom line was, is the connection that the show has to its family is so deep. And Warner's was aware of this. And of course, CW is very aware of this. And we're all aware of it. And to disinclude them was disenfranchising the thing. I mean, Supernatural had what, 3-4 million viewers? Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I can't walk down the street now, years after I'm done, without somebody going, "Crowley," or "I love your work," or "thank you." And you got to remember the themes of what it was that we've been doing as actors and as director, was a lot of those themes touch a lot of what is going on in the world right now. A lot of that stuff is a lot to do with mental health and brotherhood and families thicker than motor oil or whatever. And, you know, the fact that caring for each other is not a dirty word. Being honest with each other is not a dirty word. Calling people out who are not doing well and literally putting your hand out and helping them. And, you know, there's a lot of personal stuff in Rob's songs, very personal stuff in Rob's songs that touches the hearts of those that have actually read his lyrics and scream his lyrics from the other side of the stage. You know what I mean? Screaming at him. And it's a union. It's, you know, we don't exist without our audience. And I always used to say, with television, we make TV with 150 of our friends. You know what I mean? Right. I mean, it's like everything we do. One of my favorite moments ever in Supernatural is we did that episode where all those geese were outside, Rich, when you were directing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah,
and,
exactly.
Yeah, million geese sitting in a field in some way. It was really bizarre. And I was supposed to be projected through a door. Right. So we do all these things. We think of all these things. We work on this stuff. I know what Rich wants to do. We had a light that kept going on and off, and we had all the rest of this crap going on. I mean, it was the middle of the night. It was freezing, and we're late, and we're doing all this stuff. But it's 150 of our friends. And we do that, and we finish it, and we wrap it up, and it's done. And then we give it out to post-production, and then they make it better, and they put the things in that make people laugh, and they put these lovely little touches in. But we don't know until we go to a convention. We haven't actually sat with our audience until we've gone to a convention.
Right.
And once we go to a convention, that union, that perfect union that we get on stage when we're playing, happens with our audience in guest talks. It happens with our audience one-on-one. It happens in a way that no other show has ever given me the opportunity to do.
Right.
So, you know, the best gag in the world was I was sitting in Warner Brothers. I don't know if you know, I was sitting in Warner Brothers and I had to do the ADR for me going through the wall, or the barn door, and or Corey had to hit the tractor. Remember that? It's one of the best stunts I've ever seen. Doesn't get any credit for that, but he literally traveled 20 feet into a tractor.
Not a foam tractor, by the way, just a tractor.
A Massey Ferguson. No, from the 50s. It was like, it was a piece of metal.
Wow.
and I thought, I think this, I got a funny feeling I can make Bob and Rich blow snot out of their noses. So I did the girliest scream I've ever done in my life, which was so perfect for Crowley, which stayed in. It's my favorite scream ever. It's my version of the Wilhelm scream.
Right.
And I hope you steal it sometime and put it into something else. But that's what we do. That's the stuff that we do that we know how to do, that if it comes off, it's brilliant, yeah, etc. The stuff we do on stage, the stuff we do in a guest talk, is about what is in front of us and what the communication is and how somebody's feeling. Uh-huh. And I used to get bored sitting on a stage being asked questions by somebody. And it's like, what's it like working with Jensen and Jared? And all this, you know, what's Misha like? Do you guys ever play pranks on each other? I mean, it's like, that's the endless thing. So I just used to jump the stage, go down and assault the audience.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's what I did. And that was the fun part of my day. Yeah. But the reason was to read the audience. The reason was is to find out how they are. So the stuff I'm saying at the end is really understanding that I've just spent 45 minutes or an hour making fun with people, mm-hmm, not of people, but with right, people. Mm-hmm. I make fun dressed as Misha, but that's just a running, long-running right, gag. Yeah. But you're seeing them and you're in their faces and you see what's going on and people so nervous to ask a question, they can barely breathe. And people who have masses of issues, be it physical, be it mental, be it just daily struggles, but people struggling to do this and they want to share their time with me. Mm-hmm. They want to come and be abused by me at a panel. Right. My job and my duty is to try to codify that and try to make that an experience of some sort. Mm-hmm. So everything I used to say at the end, I thought was really important to say, no matter how much fun we're having, you know, if you're struggling, get help. Those things that we talk about all the right, time, mm-hmm, you know, you're not on your own. Right. But I don't tend to slogan things because I guess Crowley was a slogan, you know, a slogan queen, I guess, yeah, in the supernatural world.
He did have some great lines.
Well, did you ever see that the last gig I did? I think it was either San Francisco or somewhere. The last one I did with you guys was everybody held up paddles with a line of mine on it.
Oh,
it was about 80 paddles.
Yeah.
And it was mind-blowing because the context kept coming to me.
Right.
So it wasn't the lines. Some of the lines are like hysterically funny. All the writers over the years have written great gags for me. But stuff, and it was just the connection. But again, the connection with the audience.
Yeah.
A lot of people wonder why I don't do the creation shows. And the main reason, people have to know, the main reason why I didn't, and the absolute truth of why I didn't and why I didn't want to. I was offered another year and I didn't take it. And it's because leaving the show, which is my business with Bob and the rest, which is nothing to do with my fellow actors or anything else. I didn't want my friends spending a year being asked questions about when am I coming back and why was I killed or why was this happening? I didn't want Ruth, who I love with all my heart, I didn't want to do any panels with Ruth where they just constantly asked her questions about me. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was fair for my friends. I'm happy my friends were working, so happy my friends were working and that they were doing so well and they were able to carry forward and, you know, 12, which I didn't think was a particularly great season, flipped really, you know, really well into a reboot. And, you know, my dearest friends managed to carry this forward and do another 3 years of great work. And I didn't need to be in the way. I literally would have been like a carbuncle on the side of it.
Right.
And I knew I was loved and I knew I was cared, but it was also bloody contentious because of, you know, gossip and people's ideas of what was going on. And the truth of the matter was it was time to take a break, mm-hmm, and let my friends be my friends and do what they were doing, which was support a really good show that they were all still in.
Yeah.
You know, it did feel a little bit like, you know, we're all having a party. Everyone take one step forward, not so far, Shepherd.
Right,
but there's no animosity there. I was done. It was time to be done. I didn't want to come back and do bits.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do any of that stuff. And I hope nobody thinks it's about us, because, mm-hmm, you know, we've had our fights, we've had our ups, we've had our downs, but that's what happens when you spend 26 weeks, yeah, with a year. Totally. With your friends.
Totally.
And,
right,
and it's got nothing to do with it. It's like, I love you all so dearly. And I enjoy and relish watching you continue and develop and adapt and watching Rich becoming successful doing something he loves with all his heart. And he's really damn good at it as well. I mean, really damn good at it. And, you know, that's the thing. And I hate the idea that, that there's some sort of secret, because there isn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I don't want to put words in Rob's mouth, but I never got the sense, whatever the exit strategy of Crowley was from the, or lack thereof of exit strategy of Crowley from the show, I never felt like was visited on the con circuit. I never felt like there was a negativity to, you know, like, because you're a beloved figure, and I never felt like that waned in the world of the convention. You know what I mean? Like, I never...
It would have just been too complex. It would have just literally been the 800-pound gorilla in the room. It just would have been endless. It would have been an endlessly miserable experience for everybody, having to answer questions about something that's still ongoing for my friends. And now it's done, mm-hmm. and now everybody's in the same boat. Yeah. We are all part of something mm-hmm. that means an awful lot to not only us, but other people. Yeah. And that's a glorious and blessed thing.
Yeah, and something that God... way bigger than any of us could have imagined. And you know what I mean? I mean, and we were on the air for, the show was on the air for 15 seasons. It's remarkable there wasn't more actual drama. You know, and I don't
even,
I don't think what happened with you as particularly drama, just it, like you said, it kind of had run its course and you were moving on.
I was not that excited by what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And they were a little stuck on where they needed to go. And they had a very definite idea about what this next chapter was. Mm-hmm. And I think 90% of it was a money issue, to be absolutely honest. Right. And it was just like, I don't really want to go backwards. I'm on the poster, for God's sake. So I don't do windows. You know, I'm not going to come and do that. And I just thought it hadn't gone well, you know. But, you know, I called and thanked everybody. I thank my bosses and the powers that be. And they were all like, you know, you're welcome. Thank you for giving us what you gave us. And I'm happy to have been part of something that we all built.
Right.
We all built this.
Right.
You know?
I mean, look at my wedding, for God's sakes. Yeah. My wedding was the greatest example.
Great day.
The last year of my working, people took their time off from their vacation in Canada, from their vacations, some people were going to Mexico, those that could afford it.
Yeah.
Every single person was invited.
With one clear exception. One person said...
I wasn't invited. Tina,
that's not true. You were invited.
No, I wasn't invited. I was directing the hardest episode, in the middle of prepping the episode. And that was the... But I did get my Mark out in time to get married. I remember, like, that was my wedding gift.
That's the truth.
That was your wedding gift.
Oh, my God. Because Mark had a huge arc in that episode. And we're like...
Yep.
And it was Mark, young Mark. It was flashback Crowley with clean shaven. And then we had I had more conversations about Mark's stubble than I've had about having children. I mean, it was long. And
the most amazing, you got to give credit to the boys too, is that Jared had the plane standing by.
Yeah.
So it was like, you go
because
you're getting married. We'll come coach, you know? And that's the thing. It's like, you know, we had painters and accountants and grips and electric and camera and kids and people. And it's just, and that to me is the thing. And the great joke was, I mean, you understand the whole point of that was, is I went, how can I walk around a set? There's going to be people I've known for years who may not like me very much. I am an acquired taste at times, but there's people, you know, everybody knows me and is kind to me, but I'm not going to walk up to select groups of people and say, do you want to come to my wedding? So I said to my wife, I said to Sarah, I said, what do I do? And she said, invite them all.
Hmm.
I walked out on set one day and just went, okay, I'm getting married this day. Everyone cheered. And I said, you're all invited. If you get there, you get there and we'll take care of you. And everybody showed up in black tie. I mean, it was mind blowing.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah. I had to rent a black tie, but I was there.
You look superb.
I want to circle back.
Did anybody toss you their keys and go, don't park it near anything.
Jason would have done.
It was the only time I've driven a Porsche. I got to circle back to the hamster story because we didn't finish that. And for the people that don't know what we're talking about.
Okay.
So I'm backstage at Comic-Con. Rich, this is a bad idea. Then, Rich, why don't you take us through what happened next?
Well, Rich. For starters, do you have the hamster? Like, is the hamster there in your office? It exists somewhere.
Well,
it used to be. It was at our old office.
Yeah. Well,
let me look as you're telling the story.
So the hamster was character where Crowley had zapped a witch into the body of a hamster. That had been the story.
Oh, one of my greatest times ever was talking to a hamster in a tank with a necklace around it. And doing
right, things. Exactly. So you had, like, you did, your hamster was your co-star. So Rob and I thought it'd be great to have the hamster make an appearance. So we, you know, got Amazon to send us the closest approximation of a stuffed hamster.
Yep.
And Rob did the puppetry, uh-huh. and I did the voice. And it's, right. and the hamster, which no one knew, but the hamster is from a little area, a little section of Brazil, uh-huh. where there's a strong French-Mexican influence.
No. Italian, Argentinian.
Yeah. It's a very, very niche neighborhood.
Very niche. No one ever knew
and
that.
And it kept changing between the
yes,
two.
Yes, it did. Yeah. Well, it was nervous. And
so Rich bent down beneath me, so I'm just at the podium holding holding this guy, the hamster.
And I'm doing the hamster voice. It just makes me laugh like a
God,
it was super funny.
Yeah.
I was crying. Yeah. I was literally crying.
And so the amazing thing, like we said, we had these plans. How would Mark react? And Mark immediately, like a brilliant improv artist, went right with it. Just yes, anded the bit, and started talking to the hamster, and it was brilliant. It was really, and it put us immediately at ease because we were in front of 6,000 people.
It was your first time,
doing it. Which, by the way, a lot of people thought was a terrible idea. Like, we, you know, again, I remember Holly Ollis was nervous. She's like, so can you walk me through the bits? I'm like, no.
I love Holly.
Oh, she's great. God bless her. Let us do it.
Every year they would do this, but the first year it was especially nerve-wracking. They would say the things we can't talk about.
Yep.
Oh, Lord.
And that was
the list.
The list. And the list of things.
And the talking points.
They had talking points, but they would have a list of things we couldn't talk about. And some were so obtuse that had they never mentioned it, it wouldn't have been in our brain. But now we're like, oh, my God, whatever you do, don't say Missouri Mosley.
Now they're stuck in your head.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they're like, don't mention Missouri Mosley. We're like, who the hell is Missouri Mosley?
we won't?
My favorite was the fact, you got to remember that Misha and I used to have to go out there on Friday and arrive there and stay there and then do the press for the year. So after 8 years, we were bored out of our minds trying to find things to do. And so all the great photographs of me and Misha and all the great little snippets of me and Misha are from literally doing 12 hours a day of Warner Brothers talking points to 150 different sources. Right. And the boys would come out on the next day and do that. And then everybody would, you know, bar me, would go out and have a drink after we'd done the big deal. And then we'd go over to Nerd HQ. And those were the ones that were insane. I mean, that was just, we got horses' heads. And,
right.
I mean, you'd have to watch, if you haven't watched them, watch them. But it was, you know, we do, the big thing about the Supernatural announcement, the Hall H announcement, was the story so far. So we would show the clips of what we'd just been doing. And we were now, we'd be in episode 4 or something by the time we got there. It was always about episode 4. Yeah. So we only had stuff from 1, 2, 3, and 4. And they would cut a reel to show a teaser of where we were going. And it was just so much fun to do. Yeah. And people stayed up all night and queued outside. And Misha used to send pizza to them all. And it was just, it was a monumental thing. Was. For a show that was so small in conventional footprint, it has such a massive impact on so many people. I wanted to ask you guys something. How did you meet?
Ooh.
I'll tell you, Rob and I, the actual, like, I think we crossed paths in our life just being of similar type and auditioning, you know, for similar things. But we really met in the Supernatural world. I think we got paired to do a convention, got paired to do a panel together. Like, wasn't that it?
No, actually before that, I mean, yes, we did. We tell it as a funny story, but our paths crossed a lot. I shot a sitcom that he was friends with the showrunner. Different things.
We would just bump into each other in the industry.
I knew him as this big commercial actor. If Rich was in the waiting room, you audition for commercials, you're like, well, I'm out. This guy's going to get it.
But you say that about everybody, Rob. It doesn't matter. Even like some 94-year-old lady sitting next to you. Like,
I'm out. I'll never get this.
Stronger choice.
So then Rich and I, the band played a one-off show at the Burbank Convention out by the airport.
Right.
And Rich was there. And kind of watched our show and then stood in line with the rest of the fans to get our autograph afterward and came up to our table and was like, hey, I'm Rich. It's really, you
How
guys
much you
really
charge him?
What's that?
Yeah, I still have that. It's very expensive.
How much should you charge him?
Yeah.
And Norton wouldn't personalize. You know what I mean? Like everybody else, dear Rich. Norton's like, sorry, buddy.
Yeah.
But that was because he's a drummer and he can't. He's a drummer and he can't.
And you know, and that was when we kind of officially. But then Rich and I, I remember bonding with him and going, oh, wow, this guy and I really get it in the same way. We were in Rome. It was the first year I was in Rome. And you were there too, Mark.
But that's exactly right, man.
Rich and I got there early.
That's right. We both ended up walking around Rome to kill time, like a jet-lagged day of like, let's just go and walk and not walk. And I think Sebastian was a part of that
and Sebastian.
Group. And I, you're exactly right. And that's what I remember thinking, shit, man, this guy's funny. And our senses of humor seemed to like complement each other. Like I was like,
very much so. I mean, you two are fantastic with each other. It's, I mean, we're all good at doing what we need to do to keep the funny going. But you guys have something special there, which you've always had, which I love. Well,
thank you.
And it's, I love that it turned into, you know, getting you up on stage and singing, which you sort of decried doing for a long time.
Yeah.
You were really
kicking and screaming. I went, yeah. Well, so honestly, good. Like you, Mark, like I'd been in bands, but I didn't have your musical career, but I had been in bands as a young man, but it'd been years. Like I had stopped. I stopped as soon as I started. As soon as JC and I started having children, I stopped playing music. Really.
Yeah.
So it had been 10 years since I'd done anything on a stage with anybody. And my entire musical career had been based on the idea that I bet I can wrangle free beer out of this. Like it was never like the Rich Spate show. It was like me and five guys going, if they give us a couple of pitchers, you guys want to play 5 hours? Yeah. Okay. And that's what we would do. And we were cover bands.
Yeah, I've been
like
there.
We weren't Loudon Swain. We were playing all the blues of everything. You know, old rock and stuff from college forward, we'd like have the occasional original, but basically that's not what we did. We were a band, like play whatever.
So have you done the this question is for Jim bit?
No, I don't think we've ever done the this
not
question
on the
is
podcast,
for Jim.
No.
No.
It's the greatest.
It's a great bit. It's one of Rob's, on the highlight reel for Rob Benedict. And there's something our audience should know, because they see a lot of happy-go-lucky Rob on this podcast and my show. But there's nothing funnier than an angry Rob. There's nothing funnier than an angry Rob. And you know I'm right, Rob, because there's like when you get mad, dude, that's when the speed bumps come out and the comedy just goes boom, 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 boom.
He starts shaking. He gets 40 times faster.
Yeah. Let me pardon my French.
The pitch goes up. It's so good.
And that's when he was an old, just so you know, the original, this question is for Jim, audience of one, me, because we were on an airplane and he had a meltdown because, when he found out that he wasn't invited to Brazil.
Right.
But Jim Michaels was.
For the Brazil, yes, for the Brazil convention.
He had an absolute apoplectic meltdown. And did a bit that I literally had to ring the flight attendant because I lost my ability to breathe. I'm like, I was dying. It was genius.
So off you go.
All right.
I was
like,
come on.
Rob, explain.
I was like, what are they going to ask Jim, you know? And I
well, you
got to
set
this.
You got to, who's Jim? Like, you're giving the whole scenario
for
everybody.
So Jim Michaels is the line producer, right?
Dear friend.
Lovely
of all
fella.
Us.
Dear friend, lovely man, but the line producer of Supernatural. And he was on the roster of the people that were going to be in Brazil. And I couldn't imagine like how that was more.
Because typically for people who haven't gone to concerts, usually actors are
actors,
the guests,
right.
Actors.
And I wanted to go to Brazil. And so they,
going up already. It's going up already.
And so I was like, what are they going to ask him? You know? And so I started doing this bit, which is essentially, you know, this person in the audience who knows everything about making TV shows. So they're like, you know, oh my God, you know, by the way, Rich does this so much better than me. And that's why we've say the bit got spaded from me.
Yeah.
Rich took the idea and he ran with it and made it.
First of all, I that's not true, because to this day, Eugenie of Bob and Eugenie says, oh, I heard Rob do the original, because Eugenie heard the story. And she wanted to hear the original. She wanted to go back and hear the original. You know, she heard somebody else covering Satisfaction and then found out it was a Stones tune. You know, she wanted to go back and hear the original. And she, wherever you did the bit for her, she returned to set going, he's a genius. You can pack it away. Like,
anyway, yeah, it's a person who asks these questions. But my question is for Jim. Like, I, you know, Misha, huge fan, Jensen, Jared, everybody else. But my question is for Jim. you know, and then proceeds to ask Jim some TV making question. And anyway, Richard was rolling with laughter. And then, you know, as soon as we all but got back together again, Rich told the story as his own. And
not true. I always gave you credit. I would always say, like, Benedict did this bit on the plane, and it killed me.
Jim was crying.
Well, this is where you're nutbag, Shepard, because you are like, we're doing it in the green room of Brazil, and it's destroying. I'm like, oh my God, I love you so much, but you know, and doing the whole thing because when Robert did it, he did this high voiced fan. It's like, next question. I just want to say it's so wonderful to have you in my country. And awesome! It was like, it's like staring at pure light, Jared. Your hair looks like Jesus himself. Did your wig. But my question is for Jim. Jim, when you're working with a technocrane, but you do not have a union operator. Now, given it's an indie, but you're pulling up the big box for the big toy. So, here comes a union rep, and you need them like you need a second asshole. So what do? Do you put the pin in the whole short plan? Or do you say, yeah, no problem, and you put the fake weird and big beard and wig on your non-union operator and have them sneak in the back door and do the shot anyway?
You know,
like, they're trying to ask the most technical.
And then we just go on, we, you know, we're like, so you get goldenrod pages that morning, and the studio's breathing down.
It had, the more technical the question, the better the bit. And it kept doing
it. It was so specific. It was like, it was to do with overtime hours and
cranes.
Right. So we're shooting day for night.
But Richard, tell what Jim's reaction was.
Well, then Shepard goes, we're doing this bit in the green room in Brazil. And we all end up in a van, and Shepard turns to me like an a-hole and goes, hey, Jim's in the van. And he goes, hey, Rich, do my question is for Jim, for Jim. It was never on my battle plan to do the bit for Jim. And because it was Rob, like, venting about, like, so I'm like, oh, man. And I literally sort of flop sweating. I'm like, I don't know. And Mark's like, come on, it's going to kill. Which is always a death sentence, by the way. As soon as somebody says, your bit's hilarious, do it for the guy it's about.
It killed. It literally killed. He was crying.
But don't forget the first thing he said. I go, I did the bit, and I'm like, and he's like, did your location scout get a waiver? I mean, like, he literally he asked like he had a real question. I'm like, Jim, that's not the, that you, it's a fictional.
That's why it was brilliant.
I mean, his answer was technical. He's like, well, walk me through how many background you got.
You know, actually, that's a Bob Singer question. I can't.
Now, that's the rule. Now people begin to understand what the rule is. If it's funny, you do it. If somebody hands you the ball, you got two choices. You look at it or you pass the ball.
I got Mark teed me up for one of my funnier bits in France, where Mark literally came out. And I mean, this is how to steal focus without saying I'm going to steal focus. Mark came out and laid down on the sofa.
No, between two chairs.
Well, I mean, but like completely eliminating my ability to sit and took over. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he goes, backstage, he had said, I'm going to do this thing. I'm like, oh, cool. He went on to say, didn't do that thing, did a whole different thing. And he laid out on the thing. And I'm like, what the hell? So then I'm like, shit, I got it. So I went in the audience. And that's when the excusez-moi bit came from, which is me scooting through the audience, which they thought was hilarious.
35 minutes of school French. 35 minutes of school French. It was so good. And I just sat there, laying on my back with a microphone. Occasionally, I go, "No."
Yeah,
and that was it.
And I came off sweated through my clothes, like doing my excusez-moi bit, doing all the heavy lifting. We came off stage. I said, "Mark, you mofo, I literally had to do all the work in that panel." And he looked at me dead serious and says, "You're welcome," because it had been really funny. it had paid off, but it was.
Well, there's a rule. If you're funny or you're good or you're what, you know, that's the point. That's the whole point. Yeah. The band was too good to be doing covers. You know, the actors are too funny to be doing written,
boring
run-of-the-mill stuff. And it's whoever got, you know, going with it was
well,
everything.
I will say that's having seen how the model started and where it went in the convention world, where it's like one guy in a stool answering mundane questions, turning to the right, then turning to the left. And, you know, it's just that energy's vacuum. You know, by the time we were doing this really well, it was fun. You know what I mean? It's very improv-y with anybody. Obviously, Rob and me together. But
it comes down to the common denominator, which is we owe the audience.
And we trusted each other. Like, that's the other thing. Yeah. No matter who you got paired with, you're like, okay, whatever. We'll make this. We've never been paired before. Cool. We'll mix this up.
Right.
Now, Mark, you used to say something else that I wanted to bring up because I thought it was really cool. You were always such a proponent way before this volatile series of elections of the last, you know, 4 to 6 years. You've always been such a vocal proponent of people getting involved in politics, in local politics, which I always thought was really cool. You always used your platform as a performer and a man who had a microphone and an audience to always, again, wrap up your session with, yeah, vote for president, but also vote for councilman. Vote for your local people.
School board.
Yeah.
School
Pay
board.
Attention to what's going on and vote. Because you always say, like, I'm a new American. I was a, you know, like, and you would use that.
A newly minted American. Always just say newly minted American. And listen, before anybody gets weird about this or whatever, you have to understand that the basis of this is I think America is the greatest country in the world. I do. And I've thought that for many, many years. And we have our faults and we have our issues and we have our stuff. And sometimes we're an elephant and we get going and it's really hard to steer or it's really hard to change anything that we do. But it is still the greatest country in the world, just from the possibilities, just from the sheer ability for us to do it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, Americans are, you know, Flight 93. They're the three service people on a train in France. They're the people. You tell an American what is going on, he gets up and he does something about it. That's the way it's been. And that's what I've always looked up to. I've lived in other countries. I've lived in socialist countries. I've lived in all sorts of different places in Europe.
Right.
And the truth of it is our system, as fallible as it can be, is still the best system in the world. And it's made up and it's bigger than the sum of its parts. And so my talking about voting is not specifically about voting for somebody that I
100%.
Like.
And I should have said it's that about, it was never
no, but it's
party
vital
specific.
To me. It's that I will fight for your right to vote. Mm-hmm. Because when I was made an American, there was a president, our first black president, 40 feet high, giving us a message and say, right, you've got all these rights. What are you going to do about your responsibilities? And your responsibilities, your civic duties, your community duties, all the rest of this stuff. How can we help? Because that's a lot of what has gone away. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of shouting. There's a lot of stuff going on. But we are people that when we help, a change comes. And when you've been part of the supernatural family as long as we have, we see it actually working. We have seen it working. Mm-hmm. As simple as you know, a phone call between you two in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. I can think of a lot of other shows where that phone call wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
I can think of a lot of other circumstances where that wouldn't have happened, but not on this show, not with these people, not with the way that goes. And, you know, as I say, I've said it many times in conventions, it's like, you know, somebody falls over in a convention, 50 people go to help them in the supernatural convention. And then somebody will shout, stand back, give them some room. Cause that's usually overappreciated. But there's people there who understand and people who care. And it's by being vocal about what has happened to ourselves, it covers all the spectrum. It's political, it's sociopolitical, but it's inclusive. It's such an inclusive thing. We don't give a damn about sex and gender, and we do give a damn about the fights over it, but we do not give a damn about your sex, your gender, who you sleep with, who you love, who you vote for. But that's not what it's about. It never has been. And it's the most egalitarian system I've ever seen is the microcosm of the supernatural family within, you know, this great system of ours. Mm-hmm. And I think it's our duty, you know, those of us who care to encourage others to participate in their own future, mm-hmm. and their own present, whether they believe it's going to change something or not, it's not the point. Mm-hmm. The point being is to encourage people to take an active part in things that can help change their lives and help change other people's lives. We see so much kindness. We see so much care in Supernatural. We see people having panic attacks. We see people having medical issues and immediately are helped. It's not, you know, somebody else's issue. It's our issue.
So I think maybe you're one could say that your comment about getting involved is more than just about politics, because you're right. It was never about parties. It was never about, and that's what I admired about it. It was never like, vote for my guy. It was pay attention, care, get involved. And I guess that you could kind of use that approach to so many facets of life. That's why it's such a
I think that's a universal message. And you know, the trouble is we've lost a lot of the ability to discourse.
Which
I unfortunately believe is deliberate. I think it makes certain bad things easier to do when people aren't talking to each other. I find when this country, you know, with a strong GOP and a strong Democratic Party, things get done in a very different way. And I find that it's become the politics of shouting a lot and actually not doing anything, which appalls me, because we have such ability, such power, such money, such, you know, and we do generally, we have a country full of concerned people. I mean, I travel out to the, you know, to the poorest places in the world where I see the kindest people in the world. You know, it seems to only change when it's about, you know, don't scratch my really expensive car, don't get off my lawn.
Right.
Who are you? What are you doing here? And when we're not like that, when we're encouraged to not be like that, we're all embracing and we're all we're helpful and we're people that care about each other. And I, you know, I'm sober, God, coming up 32 years.
Amazing.
And I saw it in AA for 32 years, and I see it in Supernatural conventions, and I see it. But I do see it dribbling out, and I do see the positivity of that. It's that, you know, and I urge you, as a true statement, it's like, I don't care who you vote for. I care that you read up who they are, who they're supported by, where the money's going, do your due diligence, look at your stuff, and see who the right person is for you. That's the most important part. You know, but voting against your own interest is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. And in a country that's so powerful and so able, that's what frustrates me more than anything else, you know? Yeah.
And well said.
Your interest may be different than mine.
Well said. Wow. Mark Shepard, thank you so much, man, for doing this. Long overdue.
Pleasure, my brother.
Sorry it's been so long. We love having you on. We love you. We love your work. We love all the experiences we've had together, and so happy to know you.
And
have you watched Doom Patrol yet?
I love Doom Patrol, and you're great on Doom Patrol.
I hope you get a chance to come and play with us. Either of you, actually.
We both love to.
We've got a very favorable boss. I hope you're pitching for that.
We'd both chomp at the bit to be involved, because it's a great show. Truly a great show. If you haven't seen Doom Patrol, everybody, check it out.
Please check it out. Yeah.
Mark Shepard, everybody. Happiest of holidays. Happy New
Year. Thank you, Mark.
Best to your family.
Love to your family.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you so much for being a part of this.
All right. All the best.
Cheers. It's a King's Car.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. And sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues. And it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before, because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.